It's deja vu. This moment's happened before.
You have found the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Kaleidoscope Gallery. I'm your host, Paul Edwards, and alongside our guests, Hans, Leah, and Dave, we will be exploring the Natural Law Party and their mysterious yogic flyers, Apollo astronaut Edgar Mitchell's thoughts on creativity and intuition, exoplanets and space travel, and why certain songs resonate with us. So let's get into the first exhibit inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
During this election, you've heard a lot about yogic flying and the experience of bubbling bliss. That's because 7,000 yogic flyers can create a perfect government with the ability to satisfy everyone. All of our national problems are basically caused by stress. And the best antidote is transcendental meditation and 7,000 yogic flyers, which can eliminate stress in the whole country, create an integrated national consciousness, and prevent problems. For a perfect government, vote the Natural Law Party.
In the early 1990s, well-known Canadian magician Doug Henning ran as a national political candidate under the banner of the Natural Law Party. Now, while it might be slightly unusual for a magician to run for office, there is something even more unusual about the Natural Law Party's platform. The main plank of the platform promised that by deploying 7,000 so-called yogic flyers all at once, that alone, according to the, quote, science of natural law, would create a perfect government that would solve almost all society's problems, ushering in an era of peace and harmony. But what is yogic flying? And did Doug Henning win his election? We are joined by our friend Dave, who actually met Doug Henning in person while he was on the campaign trail making his case for the Natural Law Party and its mysterious yogic flyers.
You know, at the time I was living on Girard East here in Toronto, like across from Stanley's Variety, where they sold 25-cent cigarettes and Doug Henning canvas door to door. And I actually have the Natural Law flyer in a folder in my basement with Doug Henning's signature, because I went down. Like, I wasn't really political, but I knew I was into natural law. Like, from as soon as I saw that there was a magician who could be our leader, because you get a lot more power with magicians as leaders.
Right. So Doug Henning, because he was a pretty famous magician, I would say, right? Around the world? Kind of like a Canadian export?
He was. I mean, he wasn't as big as Ravin, the hypnotist. He was the Canadian king. He wasn't as big as... there was a Canadian who worked the scene in Vegas for a while.
The amazing Randy?
Yes, Randy and his 17 Tigers.
Oh, wow. Yeah, actually, James Randy just passed away a month ago.
Should we have a moment of silence? Beautiful.
Yes, we should. We just did.
We made him disappear.
So the signature, your Doug Henning signature on their campaign poster material, you got that in person.
I did. Yeah, I went to the campaign meeting, and I witnessed a display of yogic flying. And I did not attempt to yogic fly because I'm not at a high enough level in the world of natural law. But I did witness a yogic flyer, and it was quite amazing. Like, they were able to leap off the ground, maybe four feet. Like, I could, as they were flying across the room, I could see beneath them and had time to read everything that was on the old blackboard in the church basement or whatever. I read like a novel while they were still in the air. And then they slowly came down, like almost levitating. And they were making a buzzing sound, like it was really interesting. And I think there was a tambourine in the room. And then I got Doug Henning's signature.
Were you actually there at that meeting?
I was. I actually have the card. It's still here somewhere. If this is a video cast, I'd be able to pull it out. It was basically, I can describe it. It was about 2 inches wide by 6 inches long. It was like a heavy cardstock with a all blue print of Doug Henning's face with long hair. And it just said, enjoy natural law party underneath his face. And then he wrote to me, he's like, to Dave, enjoy the magic of natural law, Doug Henning.
Wow.
Yeah. I should find it. I think
that's a hell of a, that's some serious memorabilia, I would think.
Oh, it is. I should frame it.
It's a piece of Canadian history, but the Natural Law Party actually formed in Britain.
Really?
Yeah, I learned that.
Tell me that story.
Well, that I don't really know. Well, okay, the story of yogic flying does begin with in India with the Mahesh Yogi. Do you know the guy that was like kind of popular in the late 60s? The Beatles went to, members of the Rolling Stones went to this place in India to chill and do LSD, or maybe they didn't do drugs, but
yes,
whatever.
Yes, I do remember that story.
That guru, he popularized transcendental meditation in the West. He made it...
Through George Harrison, right?
Well, that certainly helped. Absolutely. George Harrison was well into transcendental meditation, and... One of the practices within transcendental meditation is yogic flying, which is, I have seen it. When you were at that meeting, did they actually do the yogic flying?
No.
Because have you seen that? I showed you that video of the yogic flying. And yogic flying, it amounts to being in the lotus position and kind of launching yourself up in the air. Mm-hmm. It looks fun.
Oh, it's great. They did it in Parliament, I believe.
I mean, that would be quite the sight. If the Natural Law Party had been elected, what would government look like? And I mean, and is there a sense of like that our institutions could use a bit of yogic flying or belief in magic or something?
I think our institutions could use a little less yogic flying and a little more like meditation.
Needless to say, Mr. Henning did not win his election, coming in a distant fifth place. So, we may never learn if 7,000 yogic flyers can create the perfect government.
You are listening to The Kaleidoscope Gallery.
I'm Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14 astronaut. I had an experience coming back from the moon that it caused me to start focusing myself on what is the nature of consciousness, because I had a very powerful experience while I was in space. But what I want to talk about today is the fact that 500 years ago, thanks to philosopher René Descartes, who said we have body and mind and physicality, spirituality, belong to different realms of reality that don't interact. For 400 years, we have lived with that dictum, such that when Kepler and Newton created the beginning of what we call modern science, that subject, the subject of mind and consciousness, were a no-no subject for science. They were not considered proper scientific subjects. Now, that lasted for 400 years until Max Planck and Einstein and the greats of the end of the 19th century came along and started experimenting and realizing that something was missing, and that something that was missing is now called quantum mechanics. They had it pretty well formalized and formulated so that the mathematics of it were quite well known by the 1920s. But it's taken us the entire 20th century and into the 21st century to accept the fact that consciousness, which is what the quantum world is all about, and let me illustrate that with a very simple idea. Mom and Dad go out for dinner, leave Johnny home with the babysitter. Halfway through dinner, Mom jumps up, something's wrong with Johnny at home, calls home. Sure enough, he fell out of his high chair, bumped his head, and a screaming bloody murder. How did Mama know that? That's quantum entanglement. And that is, I'll call it intuition, but we call our intuition our sixth sense, and it really should be called our first sense because it's more fundamental. It's been around forever, and it is a part of the fundamental properties of nature.
In an interview with NASA's Johnson Space Center Oral History Project, Edgar Mitchell, former Apollo 14 astronaut and one of the few humans to walk the surface of the moon, experienced an epiphany while he was gazing at the scene outside the capsule window on his journey from the moon back to the Earth. And he described it this way. Quote, "All of a sudden, I realized that the molecules of my body, my colleagues, and the spacecraft were prototyped in an ancient generation of stars. And somehow it suddenly became very personal instead of an objective. My molecules were made of those stars, and this was a real wow." He goes on, quote, "My question was, what kind of a brain is this that allows me to see what I already know from a different perspective? Why is it letting me get excited and insightful and creative and intuitive? Why? What causes that?" Unquote. What is intuition? Is there a science behind the creative process? Or even psychic phenomena? Joining us in the Kaleidoscope Gallery to explore this idea is our friend Leo. Edgar Mitchell, who is a former Apollo 13 astronaut, He had some kind of epiphany.
Interesting man. Yes, he did.
And it led him to kind of almost in one way down a rabbit hole and another way down a very, very interesting path. And that is he somehow perceived the interconnection of everything.
Yep.
Including, this is when he was out in outer space, he had kind of a Jungian moment where just the way everything hung together, like the stars and the Earth, he was like, we're all connected. We're all made of stars, as you were saying. We're all made of the same fundamental substance that came, or not substance, but particles or whatnot, that came from
the Big Bang.
The Big Bang. Yeah. And that therefore he would say that creation itself, the creative process, is one of the essential underlying
forces of the universe.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen him, and I've seen a short film about him and other astronauts describing that phenomenon. I forget the term they use for it in the film, of when they first see the planet from space. And that's that moment, that's the term that they use that I can't remember right now. That's where I've heard his quote, where he says, as he's experiencing it, what he felt, and that connection, and we're all stardust.
And also, he would say when we experience sort of paraphysical things, such as if you've ever felt like a psychic thought, or just a vision for a creative project, or what would be another thing? Maybe even like we were talking about before about ancestors. Like he started this institute called the Center for Noetic Sciences, which him and his colleagues who are all legitimate scientists. This is not one of these...
It's not fringe science. This is increasingly less fringe science.
Let's put it this way. They're putting real scientific research onto these topics.
Which ones exactly? Well, what's noetic science?
They've done studies on... they take a couple, people who are, say, in love.
Sure.
And they test their ability to sort of read each other's minds.
Okay.
And I will say, and they will say, they haven't actually come up with a ton of absolutely groundbreaking, replicable. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not saying here, like, metaphysics can be turned into a science. Mm-hmm. Or we can... find out the mechanism that...
But I think neurologically we are even, because this is the whole right hemisphere part of things, right?
What do you mean by right hemisphere?
The energetic perception, right? So pre-logic, sort of pre-processor, where some degree of... instinct would come from, but also just our experience of the world energetically, so that our stardust experience of the world, that feeling of connection, that feeling that he felt, and where the creative spark, like it is the right brain that is the where that process comes from.
You are listening to The Kaleidoscope Gallery.
It means you have to be plugged into your right brain. It means you can't just be a logical bean counter. There's no vibe if you're just in your left brain, if you're just being computational and
so you're referring to the
linguistic.
You're referring to the neurological state that
right hemispheres of the brain. Okay. And they are distinct hemispheres and they're opposites of each other and they're joined by the corpus callosum.
So there's a bridge
There's a bridge between them of neurological bridge axials. The thicker the bridge, the more integrated the two hemispheres, the more genius you are, you know, the more insights, the more creative, the more vibe, the more full potential.
Okay. So let me just ask you a question. So, so left hemisphere is generally speaking responsible for what kind of functions?
Think of it as the computer. It is literally the computer.
Did I say the right brain, right hemisphere?
No, that's the left hemisphere.
Okay, so the right hemisphere then is what you might say is responsible for more of the creative, non-linear...
Like the soul. It's energy. It's pure energy. The left brain, like, parses it out for you. The right brain, like, you know, picks it up. That's why it can be more intuitional and instinctive or able to connect with things that are intangible, because it's... It's so if I understand, you know, I'm not an expert in neurology, but from what I've heard from people who are, but it's what reads the energy itself. It's so that feeling that you get of awe and interconnection, and that's the right brain's experience of the world, right? The left brain is then translating that and categorizing it for you and saying, that's a rose and that's a stem and that's a lake. And
so that's very interesting, because that's what Edgar Mitchell says, the Apollo 13 scientist, is that astronaut, is that he...
Turned scientist.
He said that it's like the particle wave duality.
Yes.
So whereas a particle... Mm-hmm. is here and now, and is tangible in a sense. A wave,
is everywhere and all potential,
exactly.
All the time.
So that, in other words,
and they're both simultaneous. They're one or the other, but they're both simultaneously. So yes.
So we are getting a little into the weeds here, because like particle wave duality is a bit of a mind bender.
It's quantum physics.
Yes, but for people who haven't studied it.
Right.
It is a bit of a mind bender. But the idea here is that you need to have both the particle and the waveform. So like the left and the right brain, like the best ideas are both. They're a duality between the two sides of your brain.
The more we become adept at both hemispheres of the brain, the more we become adept at integrating both hemispheres of the brain and using both of them all the time, And being aware or being aware and being having a choice that we want to be using one or the other more for given reason because of the context we're dealing with. The healthier and the more functional and the better adapted we are, the more we're able to really use our hardware, so to speak, our fullness of ourselves, if we can integrate both hemispheres.
Paradox, interconnection, balance. Those are themes that we are going to continue to explore in the Kaleidoscope Gallery more deeply in coming episodes.
Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1. Fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds.
X minus one.
These days, we are discovering so-called exoplanets all the time. Exoplanets are planets that orbit a star other than our sun. And some of these planets are Earth-like in nature. But the thing is, these planets are very, very, very far away from Earth. For example, Kepler-452b, a planet sometimes quoted to be an Earth 2.0, or Earth cousin, based on its characteristics, is an exoplanet orbiting the sun-like star Kepler-452, about 1,404 light-years from Earth. In other words, it would take a spaceship traveling at the speed of light 1,404 years to reach it. It's safe to say that this kind of technology is not going to happen overnight. Will it ever be possible to travel to these colossally distant planets? Back in the Kaleidoscope Gallery with us once again is Dave to explore this more.
I'm fascinated by the explosion of information around exoplanets right now. Like when you try to watch something on TV, it's all like planets from hell. But like, no. There's also like, it's just the sheer number of them is staggering. Like they were like, maybe there's a few. Like basically there are billions of other Earth-like planets, billions. And that's just like within a stone's throw, like within like a tiny section of sky that we can see. And this information is flowing in with unprecedented speed.
Yeah.
And now, like, how do we get there?
Yeah.
It's not going to be on, like, a slow boat, spaceship like we know today.
Right. Absolutely not. Our current models of propulsion are utterly inadequate for any serious space travel.
Utterly inadequate.
And also, one has to ask, If you're going to get anywhere, you have to go at least the speed of light. If you're going to cover any serious distance. And even that only gets you one light year away in a year if you were traveling at that speed. So even with these theoretically super fast travel speeds, you're still spending a lot of time in space to get anywhere.
Which is maybe why we haven't been visited. They're on their way. They'll be here in another 50 million years. Stand by.
Traveling in space through our idea of sort of going from point A to point B linearly is seems to be a washout.
That's the problem. Yeah. You got to achieve the spin, slip through the dimension, bend shit, and they bend the paper and poke a hole through it instead of going all the way around the paper.
Yeah, exactly. And to that, and would that even be done in a ship, as we call it? Like, you know, because
I think you're right. That you got to break free from the ship thinking, and then it really opens up.
You are inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery. The Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Turns out that most UFO sightings on Earth are actually not UFOs. Or I should say, they can be explained. That's true for at least, I don't know, probably 80 to 90% of UFO sightings, they're generally explained away. And this is actually according to people like MUFON, which is the Mutual UFO Network, which is, do you know about MUFON?
No, tell me about MUFON.
It's a
MUFON.org?
Probably. but it's an organization that sets up to collect and collate all of the sightings that people, so if you see, have a sighting, you call up MUFON and they'll dutifully write it down, catalog it, and if needed, investigate it further.
Do you have MUFON on speed dial?
I do.
Have you ever called MUFON?
No, I haven't. Because I haven't seen something that motivated me to report it as a UFO sighting. I've either kind of reasoned it out myself. I once thought I was watching a ship on the horizon of a lake, Lake Huron, and it was turning red, blue, and green in a succession, in a pattern, and it seemed to just be hanging there like an orb or something. Turns out I learned, much later on actually, because I kept that kind of, boy, was that an UFO? In the back of my mind for like a decade or so, until I found out it was most likely a stationary satellite.
Stationary satellite? Aren't they all moving?
Some are geostationary.
So they're moving the exact speed of the Earth. So that's interesting, because I think that is the key to fast space travel, and it's matching spins. Everything's about spinning. In fact, that's how we're finding planets, is seeing the little shadows in the spin at the exact time. It's all about timing the spin.
Interesting.
Like, that's why merry-go-rounds make people feel weird, nostalgic, and warm. Like, if you're going round and round and round, you're slowly returning to the core existence of the universe, which is all a spin.
Wow. Yeah, like the, or even like the medicine wheel, or various powerful spinning symbols throughout.
The big wheel on Price is Right.
Yeah, that is, I find that hypnotizing.
The Wheel of Fortune.
Yeah, the Wheel of Ixion. And but yeah, that spin thing is really interesting, because it's true that if you're spinning something, or you're spinning yourself, whatever, at one point the revolutions of spin get to the point where everything appears to be still, whereas you're going right at the right speed that you don't perceive that you're spinning anymore. It's like when you watch those helicopter blades a little bit, and they seem to freeze in time.
Yes.
Because they're just sort of spinning at a frequency that looks like it's still.
Yes, and I think that is a clue, because when you see it, that change from what's actually happening to what is perceptibly happening at a certain velocity of turning, you know that that's the exact velocity that you need to make a change in your current state to be able to travel through.
Okay, that's an interesting theory. And it's beyond my scope to build a device like that. Or would it be, I'm assuming it would be a device of some kind, this theoretical thing you're talking about, right? Or,
well, I'm not sure. I think that there it could be a device. It could be, I think it would be a device or it would be a program. Because we're entering the age just this week of, like, we're now injecting programs into humans. Like, that's now allowed, and that's new. That's new. So once we can do that, you know, it may not be a physical spin. It could be a changing of the trajectories, of the speeds, of the angles, of the axes, of the poles. There's a way that everything can be perfectly aligned, and then just like the helicopter blades freeze, a door might open, a portal or a fissure,
and it would be connected to the quantumly entangled or resonated particle on the other end of the waveform. So that's invoking the whole wave particle duality thing.
I believe that is the exact correct answer. What we don't know is the details. We don't have the blueprint or the code prepared for this. But it's coming closer because we see the possibilities, and we now have the ability to mess with the code, and that leads to the experiments, which lead to the breakthroughs.
While it's been a trip to cast our mind's eye to the stars and the far planets, it's time to float back down to Earth for our next exhibit.
You are listening to The Kaleidoscope Gallery. The Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Now we're going to rate a couple of records that you may or may not have heard by now. May I have your name and your age?
Valerie Waters, 20.
Thank you.
Todd Oliver, 18.
Todd and Valerie, what kind of music do you like?
New wave and disco.
And you, sir?
Kind of rockabilly, you know, just all around, something good to dance to.
I don't know what we have here today, but I'd like you to rate them between 35 and 98, and then I'll ask you whether you like them or not, or maybe you're in between, whatever. Follow the gentleman a couple of feet back there, and we'll listen to this one, I Don't Get It, by Lisa Popeil. Christy, you liked the first one a little bit better. Why?
It had a lot more energy. It was easy to dance to. I liked it.
You gave it an 81. Steve, you gave this one an 81. Why?
It's a good song. I like to dance to it.
Do you always compare notes?
No, not always.
I noticed you were in conference all the way through this. All right, let's see what we have for you.
Long after TV shows like American Bandstand that you heard in that clip served as a gatekeeper and powerful way to make or break a song, streaming services like Apple Music and Spotify were declared by their founders to be services that would democratize the music industry. Now, musical artists no longer need a record label to release their music, as they could do it themselves and be heard on massive platforms like Spotify. But when you realize that the streams generate revenue of a tiny fraction of a penny per stream for the artist, picture begins to look a little different. Recently, Spotify proposed to its content creator community that they wish for their song to be favored by their infamous algorithm, whose mysterious workings play a large role in deciding whether or not an artist's work is shown to most people. Just like the American Bandstand decades ago, there would be a cost to pay. Those artists would be asked to take an even lower share in the revenue that they would normally be entitled to. To talk about this scheme and more, we are joined in the Kaleidoscope Gallery by our friend Hans, who happens to be a music producer
the remarkable catalog of music that he's released over the years.
Ah, the end of the world. Spotify leads us into the Armageddon.
Yeah, apparently. They're part of the leading charge.
Leading charge in dissolving all creative industries and their sources of income.
Yeah, you're referring to that wonderful announcement they made, Spotify, to their, we'll call them content creators or creators, that if you want to be seen more on their platform, because they use an algorithm that somehow, you know, suggests, you know, your song to the listener based on just, I don't know what exactly what factors, but a lot of different factors. And if you want to be more seen in those algorithms, then you have to be willing to accept less royalty payment than they already pay out now.
Which is laughable, really. It's like 0.04 USD or something.
It depends on who you're distributed by, actually. The major labels have a one deal. And then a company like The Orchard, they have their own deal. And then all the other ones.
But like, it's less than a penny.
Oh, it's less than a penny.
Yeah. So
no matter what way you slice it, I think it's actually like 0.00 and then the numbers. So 1/100th, somewhere around the, you know, 1/100th of a cent category per stream.
Yeah.
And but you get paid more if the stream is from someone who's a subscriber, because there's the free tier, which is advertising. So that generates less revenue for everyone. Right. But I think that the reason why Spotify is looking towards initiatives like that is because they're not making any money.
Yeah, they're probably just desperate. They haven't shown a profit yet, right?
Right.
So
exactly.
That's kind of self-explanatory of their situation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if they're not making money.
But I mean, it looks cool.
Yeah.
And there's the accessibility to it, but I don't know. You can't get me to pay for the service. Like, I still have the free Spotify.
But do you find yourself using Spotify a lot?
Yeah, I mean, for music.
Right.
It gives me a good reference point on audio. It's better than YouTube.
Is it? Like, you find it better?
Well, right today, actually, I went and watched a music video that was published like probably a day or two ago, and the fucking mix is in mono.
Really?
And I'm like, this can't be right. Like, this sounds shitty. Like, I mean, it doesn't sound shitty. It sounds like it's in mono, so it sounds like it's not the full experience. And then I checked out the song on Spotify, and I was like, now we're fucking talking.
Ah.
It was that noticeable a difference. But, I mean, it could have been a strategic move on the artist's part, but I think that, like, they just... someone fucked up in the video editing.
Yeah, sure. As you know, putting together releases for official releases to go out there, there's actually a lot of factors that can go wrong,
A lot of dongling, for sure.
Yeah.
Can't.
Yeah, a lot of checking boxes and it's easy, especially when you're nearing the end of a project. It's easy to make the small little errors, like accidentally hit the mono button or something.
Yeah, it's just odd. In that case, I don't know, artistic strategy or just plain stupidity, but it's so blatantly obvious. Because when it's in mono, the mix is... it's not... you know, it's not like, it's just not spread out.
Yeah. And also you can get phasing issues.
Exactly. I'm like, this is a 2020 track. This should be sounding fucking rad. And it sounds like,
yeah, because that's the case. It's pretty hard to make, it's easier to make a really good sounding record now. It's easier to release your music now, but it's no easier to make a living out of it. In some ways, it may be worse, or
it's absolutely worse.
You think
so? For sure. Yeah. I would say that if you had any shred of talent, like on the golden years, probably at least for Canada, I would say were the 80s. And like people who were in bands that made it in the 80s are still chilling now.
Right. And so they had the advantage of like everyone actually had to buy records in the store. And so,
yeah.
And technology was good enough as well, so things were sounding pretty good. I mean, your gated reverb snares aside, it's like high quality stuff. And you had the music video, MTV was like a really powerful marketing tool. But how many bands never got signed to a record label and you never heard their music, you know, from that era?
Yeah. Well, the filtering, it's a filtering issue. Hmm. I mean,
like gatekeeping.
Yeah. There are, it's good and it's bad, right? Because there's so much bullshit to sort through now to find something good.
Yeah. And that's kind of what people rely on algorithms, even on YouTube or wherever. Algorithms are becoming increasingly important to do that filtering for you.
Yeah, it just seems more disingenuous because it's usually laced with like advertisement and stuff, which is, it's just more plain to the eye, I think, now than before. Because honestly, like, I don't know, I think the marketing and people who were gatekeepers up into whatever you want to say, like before 2005, I think they did a pretty fucking good job. I think they did a good job at recognizing talent and like pushing stuff. Of course, they like shaped culture more, but
the A&R is the role in the record, in a record company, the arts and repertoire role, A&R, was to scout bands, keep their ear to the ground, listen to demos, just scout, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, I think for the large part, these people really gave a shit about their job and were really about art. You know, these people who were like business people were, you know, a lot of them, the scouters were about the vibe.
Yeah. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Well, marketing obviously plays a huge role in what sells, but if it wasn't truly good on some level to someone, you wouldn't be able to sell it. So there had to be an authentic element to them, to everything that was signed. Because I agree with you, by the way, that, and yet when you had the, you know, free yourself from the record label was the mantra over the last 20 years. And yeah, there's a level of freedom there, but
I mean, there's a lack of financial security, but I mean, it's always been out of the, not in the artist's favor. I mean, doesn't mean that they couldn't sustain like a good living, but it's always skewed to like a business model that in favors like the corporation of whatever, Geffen Records or
You are inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
It's visibility. Like, visibility is the commerce of visibility is really what it,
the commerce of visibility.
Yeah, is really what's going on now, because anything that you want to sell needs visibility, and people, that's where all these companies have their clout. Big companies like Uber or whatever, Spotify, their only not their only, but their primary, like, clout badge is that they can, they have an audience.
Yes, yes, that's right. And the platform, when you, when your company's name is essentially like a verb, like, let's get in, like, to Uber. I think Spotify is actually almost like a byword for streaming now.
Yeah, it's kind of like, if you have enough investors who are willing to, like, lose, like, enough money, you'll eventually be the, like, the top dog.
Right, yeah. If you can, like, stay in the
battle.
You just
have to hold, you just have to, yeah.
Be the last man standing.
Exactly. You don't, I mean, that's what Uber, that's Uber, that's Spotify, these, all these people who try to compete, they try and then they fail because they don't, they aren't backed far enough. So it's just like Spotify and Uber are like the Bell and Rogers. They're going to become like Bell and Rogers for like internet, but for,
yeah,
whatever, like driving services or music.
Like, yeah. It's just, and like Uber itself also doesn't yet make money.
That's, yeah, but they're just, they hope to just eventually dominate the market because everyone else is just going to go bankrupt. And they just...
Battle of attrition. Yeah. Do you think that these companies are kind of eyeing the near future, the near coming artificial intelligence future, where with Uber, it would be self-driving cars. With Spotify, it could be, say, artificially generated music, so that you're actually slowly over time eliminating the human factor. Like, maybe Spotify could be profitable if they didn't actually have to pay like real people royalties. They just generate the music from an avatar or something, you know?
Yeah. It's an interesting take.
Yeah, we went there. AI-generated music. That's an exhibit in the Kaleidoscope Gallery that Hans and I will explore further on another episode, because, believe it or not, soon, some of the music you discover on Spotify may have been generated by a budding AI superstar. But listeners, let me ask you a question. Have you ever had a song stuck in your head? I don't mean an annoying earworm that has involuntarily planted itself in your brain that you wish you could get rid of. Or a song that's been repeated 1,000 times on the radio station you listen to in your car. I mean a song that won't let go of your brain at all. The song keeps repeating in your mind and you find yourself humming it out loud a slightly disturbing amount of times in a day, but it makes you feel good. This happens to me quite a lot. The most recent song to attach itself to me like that is a song by the band The B-52s called Deadbeat Club. But what's interesting about this is, I have never really been a fan of the song before. Yes, I heard it and I thought it was kind of cool, but it would never make my top 10 or even my top 100 list. So why did I suddenly become infatuated with this song? Why now? And why that song? How did that song suddenly become the soundtrack of my life?
What is it like giving you? Like, does it evoke memory or just like energy or?
I think that's a good question. The reason why I'm obsessed with this particular song,
is it in F major?
I don't know.
That might be the case.
It's not nostalgia, actually. I can say that. I just think that it might be that, like, being a musical person, that if I hear a song that's particularly, I think, like, really, really well made, then it'll just, like, slot right into my brain like a piece of the puzzle, like, fitting perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that nice. I'm trying to learn from the song. Because it is not like annoying songs, that, you know, songs that get caught in your in your head like an earworm. They're not earworms. It's just kind of marveling at the whole work,
mm-hmm.
the performance, the songwriting, the chord changes, the instrumentation just captivates me to a point where like it just grabs really tight onto my brain. And
yeah, maybe it's just like, maybe it's not even the song. Maybe it's just like your headspace is at the right spot for like transmission of vibes. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. It's hard to say. Like, we all have preferences and shit, but I think, like, I think a lot of it has to do with where your mind's at that moment.
Interesting.
Because if you're like, I don't know. If your brain is like firing off these like chemical exchanges, and and then you hear like the song at like the right time, it kind of like opens up a pathway. You know what I mean?
That's very interesting. Yeah. So
it's like why people who fall in love think like every song on the radio is like about them. Like, you know what I mean? Like there's different.
Yeah.
Different. If your brain is like engaged in a certain uh-huh. way, it could like perceive things.
That's really interesting, man, because I think you've given me a major insight, because that song that I'd mentioned, Deadbeat Club, the sentiment of the song is really it's very joyful. It's about how could I describe the meaning of the song? It's just about actually it's just about celebration and with other people
mm-hmm.
and being legitimately happy to be with other people and going on an adventure at night. Like you're going to party and drink and have fun, whatever, but this song has this deeper resonance as far as like camaraderie, being a joyful, having like other human beings when they gather and just be happy, because you know right now in the situation COVID-19, that's just not happening.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even like an overtly social person. I'm like a social person, but it's not like I'm the type of person that's like, I wish I was going out to the clubs right now or whatever. But subconsciously, I think you're right. I was in a mental state of really appreciating what that song celebrates.
Yeah.
So that's a great point. And you're right about if you're in love or just fall in love and all of a sudden those songs just really resonate with you. Those love songs or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a super cliche kind of example, but it's depending, obviously like the art has its own meaning and it's like it's a powerful entity on its own, but when that like co-relates to your mind space and the makeup of your brain, that's when like the connection happens, I think.
There is a quote attributed to the medieval Persian poet Rumi, and it reads, "We rarely hear the inward music, but we're all dancing to it nevertheless." I hope you've enjoyed this inaugural excursion through the Kaleidoscope Gallery. Until next time, and remember, keep it surreal.
You have been listening to the many colors of the Kaleidoscope Gallery.